The Jericho Network on Westwood One.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho. Talk is Jericho, mama. Talk is me.
All right, welcome to Talk is Jericho, coming to you live from Paris in France. It's the plot of thunder and rock and roll. The remedy for boredom has arrived, and it is Friday. On Sunday, the Game of Thrones is back on HBO. Season 6 starts, one of the craziest shows that I have ever seen. I love Game of Thrones. I'm an addict. I can't wait to see Season 6. You guys know how much I dig it. That's why I had to get someone from Game of Thrones here on Talk is Jericho via my good friend and mutual friend, Andy Biersack from Black Veil Brides. John Bradley is going to be here. Who's John? He plays Samwell Tarly of the Night's Watch. That's right. Jon Snow's best friend, the guy who actually killed a White Walker. We're going to talk about all of that stuff, how and where they film it, his relationship with Kit Harington, who plays Jon Snow, how he feels about the supposed death of Jon Snow. I don't think Jon Snow's dead. That's just my opinion. John does not answer it, but I gave him my thoughts. He's got stories about how he got the gig, how he killed the White Walker, what it's like to be on Game of Thrones. He's been on the show since the very first season, and so far, fingers crossed, he has not been killed. You never know what's going to happen in Season 6, but we got a great discussion about acting and theater and chemistry and Paul McCartney. Great conversation with John Bradley. You're going to dig it, even if you don't like Game of Thrones. And if you don't like Game of Thrones, you got to go check it out this Sunday on HBO. The best show on TV, one of the best shows on TV. Before we start with John Bradley, though, let me say thanks. Thanks to all of you for listening and supporting the great sponsors of this podcast. That's why I'm able to do two episodes for you for free every single week. And there's one longtime Talk is Jericho sponsor I talk about all the time because I love the guy. I love his program. I use it. I believe in it. I'm going to do it today. After a long travel day, great matches with AJ Styles here on the European tour, I need my DDP yoga, and I am going to do it on the DDP Yoga Now app, all right? And if you still haven't given Diamond Dallas Page and his amazing fitness program a try, what are you waiting for, man? Order it now at ddpyoga.com/Jericho. And hey, if you live in Australia, DDP is going to be there next week, okay, for a double whammy, Oscar, Grammy, triple whammy, cut, that's a take, what album is that from? So here's your chance to experience DDP Yoga live and in person. If you live in Melbourne, Australia, he'll be hosting a DDP workshop on May 1st in Melbourne, and the week before, on April 24th, he's hosting a screening of this incredible documentary, The Resurrection of Jake the Snake, also in Melbourne. If you want to see the life-changing effect of DDP Yoga, check out the documentary and go do the workout with DDP. You can get tickets for both events at ticketblaster.com.au. And if you're not in Melbourne, then order your own DDP yoga program at ddpyoga.com/Jericho and get 3 free months of the DDP Yoga Now app. I use this app all the time. It's how I do my DDP yoga every time. And that's why I'm in the best shape of my life, having some of the best matches of my career, killing it with AJ Styles on the live events. If you guys live in Paris, come see the show tonight. If you live in Malaga, Spain, come see the show on Saturday and see what DDP yoga can do for you and why it's done it for me. Okay, and go use the DDP Yoga Now app. It's got all the workouts on it, all of DDP's workouts. You can also do live workouts from the DDP Yoga Performance Center. Tons of nutrition tips, inspirational stories, and videos. I like the videos. And you can even access cooking shows so you can see how to prepare healthier meals for yourself. It's also very important to your whole overall fitness regimen to eat well. The DDP Yoga Now app is available at iTunes and the Google Play Store. And when you go download it, you'll see all the amazing reviews it's getting from people just like you and me. So take advantage of the special offer DDP has given you, the sexy Beast listeners of Talk is Jericho. Order at ddpyoga.com/Jericho and get 3 free months of the DDP Yoga Now app. Get started today on ddpyoga.com/Jericho. Come on, man. Get in the best shape of your life and do it with DDP Yoga.
I've been more used to you as a maester. More used to everyone now Maester Aemon's gone. The Citadel has the world's greatest library. I'll learn about history, strategy, healing, and other things. Things that will help when they come. If Gilly stays here, then she'll die. And the baby that she named after me will die. And I'll end up dying too, trying to protect them.
So this is always funny. I did this with Jerry Ferrara from Entourage, where the first time we ever met was in a hotel room.
Yeah.
Coming to meet a strange man in his hotel room is a little bit shady under different circumstances, but I'm here with John Bradley, Game of Thrones, and it's very cool that you came here, and we have a friend of a friend that made this happen.
Yes, we do.
Which was Andy Biersack from Blackville Brides.
My good friend Andy Biersack. Yeah, I've not known Andy for that long. We just did a movie together over in L.A.,
So what movie did you do with him?
We've just been working on a movie called American Satan.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of an updating of the kind of Faust legend.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's all about the dark side and all about all the things that can befall you if you get mixed up in all that stuff. It's a really good... Because, of course, I never met any of those guys before we did this movie. And it was Andy and Ben Bruce, the guitarist from...
No kidding, from
Asking Alexandria, yeah.
Both Talk Is Jericho alumni.
Yeah, and they're really, really great guys. We had an amazing time. It's one of those things where... Yeah, because the business is so transient and you work on things for a couple of months, then you may never see people again. The hardest thing is getting to know people.
Yeah.
But with this, it was kind of the quickest chemistry that's ever formed for me on a job, really. I mean, we were literally really good friends by the end of day one. And I've been very lucky with some of the people that I have worked with so far. But these guys are right up there. You can tell sometimes that the difference between friends for the job and friends for life, you know?
Well, you can tell that right away. Usually that goes with people in general. Like, you meet somebody right off the bat, you know, okay, that guy is a solid guy. That guy can maybe one or the other, you know?
Yeah, I think you have to make the effort to... Of course. If you've got a group of strong personalities, as people with kind of artistic temperaments tend to be, you may find that you maybe don't have quite the same chemistry with other people, but as long as you get along with them and respect them, it's fine. You don't have to make a best friend on every job you do.
Well, yeah, and like you said, you always hear about like the on-set romances, and that's, like you said, on-set friendships too.
Yeah.
But to actually be able to continue that on is the real kind of tricky thing to do.
That's right. I think the best friends that you ever make are friends that you make when you're scared or nervous or...
Oh, why do you say that?
Slightly unsure of yourself. I just think when you start a new job, you do feel... And I think you should feel this. I think it's quite healthy. You do feel that you have to prove yourself all over again. So you have to make them feel they've made the right choice in choosing you for the job. And it's important to create first impressions. So everybody arrives on a new job feeling slightly unsure of themselves, like they're on slightly unfamiliar ground. And I think as soon as you latch onto somebody in that environment and under those circumstances, you tend to keep hold of them, really, because you both serve as a raft that the other person can kind of float on, you know?
Well, and especially when you're talking about, like, those guys are band guys, so they're outside of their element to be acting.
Yeah.
And you spending so much time on the Game of Thrones cast to go outside of that world is probably, you have to, like you said, it's a little bit nerve-wracking.
Yeah, and because they knew each other already, and Andy and Ben especially have been on a lot of the same kind
tours.
Of touring circuits,
yeah.
and they do a lot of these kind of, a lot of the festival circuit together as well. So, you know, I was maybe concerned that they'd maybe formed a clique already and maybe wouldn't let anybody else into it, but they were incredibly open and incredibly giving of themselves, and yeah, they just made, I'd like to think we all made each other's jobs quite a lot easier.
Were they Thrones fans too?
Yeah, they were.
So that helps as well, when you have that mutual respect, you know?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that's one of the great things about being in something that's so widely watched and so widely known is that you'll always find somebody to strike up a conversation with. If it only starts with Game of Thrones, it can lead on to something else quite quickly. But at least a lot of the barriers are kind of broken down early on. You know?
Well, like you said, yeah, because like I mentioned, when it's if you're known for Game of Thrones or being in a band or wrestling or whatever, it's like, oh, I know that guy.
Yeah.
You already kind of like that person because you know their work.
Yeah, of course.
And that helps.
And people always... surprise you, really, because people, the public perception of people is never the full story, you know, it never is. And so you get to know them, you get to know the side of themselves that they rarely show, and you find that, you know, underneath it all, no matter what reputations people carry around, they're all just people.
Yeah.
And if you talk for long enough, you'll find a shared interest, and then that can set you off and running for a
I find
a
that
time.
Especially when you meet somebody that you really admire, like that is a hero maybe of yours.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've had that experience yet, but once you kind of break down that barrier of like, oh my God, it's so-and-so, and then realize it's just a dude that's doing something cool.
Yeah.
Just like we are, you know?
And people often worry, you know, would it be embarrassing or will it will it make them cringe if I say that I like their stuff? And people always like to know that they're doing something good, you know.
Absolutely.
And I think if that's the thing I find about working in entertainment or working around these types of people. If somebody's shy and genuinely shy, that's fine for and I said normal people, that's the wrong thing to say, but that's fine for people every day. But if you've got a profile and you're shy, you can come across as quite rude.
Mm-hmm.
You can come across as quite arrogant and distant, where in actual fact you're just slightly reticent to be that giving of yourself. And that's fine. And in any group of people, beyond like three or four people, there's going to be slightly different personalities, mm-hmm. but it's all about just finding your place in
common ground with that.
Yeah.
Is that how many months of the year do you shoot Game of Thrones?
We go from the summer, kind of July, August, right up until Christmas.
And so then the rest of the year you can go get other gigs like the American Satan.
Yeah. I mean, that's the great thing about it, really. The fact that it gives you a lot of security, not only job security for now anyway, but just it gives you a kind of financial foundation where you can go and pursue things that may be slightly less slightly less lucrative, but just to kind of take you to a different artistic space,
expand your creative horizons.
Yeah,
because I'm sure now you have more opportunities with Game of Thrones being so hot.
Yeah, it's we're all finding that it's a blessing and a curse, really, because, you know, playing these parts that are, some of them are very iconic and some of them are very closely associated with them.
Right.
But so you do find that you do get a lot of opportunities, but you kind of get more opportunities to play similar characters to that.
I get you.
See what I mean? So you just have to be brave and you just have to pick and choose a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Just because you don't want to get saddled with a part,
typecast.
No, you don't really want to, but as I always say, you know, I don't think that acting jobs are necessarily a showcase for the actor to show how good they are. I think that when you act, you're serving the story, and if a job comes up which is an interesting story but the character is similar to a character you've played in the past, then you should just serve the story, really. It's not really necessarily about, oh, in this I'll show that I can do this accent, or in this I'll show that I can play this. If you like the story and you like the part, but it has echoes of something you've done in the past, then it's not up to you to change yourself to showcase your talents. It's up to you to serve the story as faithfully as you can.
I was reading something about The Martian.
Yeah.
Matt Damon got the call from Ridley Scott and said, you know, we're going to do this space movie. He's like, I've already done one or maybe two space movies out of the last few that I've done. He's like, you can't think that way. Yes, it's a space movie. It's got nothing to do with really space.
Yeah.
Because he was thinking, once again, I don't want to be typecast as the space guy now.
Yeah.
Don't worry about it. Just what's the role and what's the part that you're going to be playing within the confines of this space movie, right?
Yeah, I think that's a really sensible way of looking at it. Because one thing about Game of Thrones is I don't think it's much like other fantasy shows that you've seen. I think it is different. So if you weren't to watch it, and you were to lump it in with a lot of the other fantasy series that have been on, that would be kind of doing both of them a disservice in a way. And I think that's why a lot of people have had to take a bit of a chance with it. A lot of people come up to me and say, it's not the type of thing I'd usually watch, but I really like it. And I think that's because it's unique in its treatment of psychology and treatment of characters. And at its heart, it's a show about dysfunctional relationships within families.
Bingo.
But it's just got this backdrop of kind of a medieval fantasy thing. But if you were to just say, oh, I don't like fantasy, I won't watch that, I think you'll be missing out on all those elements that make it such a good HBO show.
Right.
In addition to a good fantasy series, you know?
I was telling my wife that because we watched the first couple episodes of Game and then she didn't like it because the dog died.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, and I was like, you have to watch it and forget about, you know, same with Walking Dead. Forget about the backdrop of the zombie apocalypse.
Yeah.
It's not about that. It's about the relationships of human beings and how they react within this horrible situation.
Exactly.
And you just mentioned the same with Game. It's okay, it's medieval times, all this stuff happens, but it's basically this functional family and the quest for power.
Yeah, and it's how being in an environment where human life is so disposable, so everything becomes extreme. It's a very extreme environment.
Right.
It's an examination of how those relationships can be conducted in such extreme circumstances.
Yeah, because there's no consequences if you kill somebody, basically. I mean, there is, but really there isn't.
Yeah, it was a time when, you know, if people say, I'm going to kill you, they meant it.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't just rhetoric. People,
yeah.
So in that situation where anybody can go at any time, and in our show, anybody can go at any time, it's interesting to examine how life is carried out in those circumstances.
Sure.
But it just reaches the conclusion that people will always be people, whether you work in an office or whether you're
right
in the court of the king. It's all about ambition and it's all about power and, you know, receiving power and losing power and how that affects people. So it's human life in microcosm just set against this quite epic background.
And you just said something that I find, like, it's such a golden age of TV right now.
Yeah,
like, there's so many great shows. And the best ones are the ones, like you said, where the tried and true tradition of whoever the lead characters are, they can die at any time.
I know.
I remember Game of Thrones, when I first got into the first season, Sean Bean, I can't remember what his name was in the show.
Ned, yeah.
Ned. He's on the cover of the DVDs.
I know.
And he, you know, spoiler alert, it's over and done with because it was 3 or 4 years ago, but he dies.
Yeah, of course.
And it's like, what?
I know.
He's like the main guy, and he dies. You think he gets beheaded, and you're thinking, okay, the cavalry's going to come and save him. There's no way he's going to die, and then he does. It just it rivets you.
Yeah, it just goes to show you from that moment on, that was the precedent set. You know, all bets are off now.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody can go. Don't think that anybody's safe. And you're right, it is a great time for TV, and I think that people are realizing now that TV is the platform to tell stories on, because you get so much more time with characters. If we were to try and condense these, it's hard enough to condense them into 10-hour...
It's a 10-hour season.
10-hour season, movie, yeah. But to do it into a 2-hour movie, 3-hour movie even, would be too much of a task. We just lose so much of it. So, and TV is where the best stories are being told at the moment, I think. And it's a great time to be an actor as well, because if you'd noticed, some of the best, or most of the best, iconic appointment-to-view TV series over the past few years have had middle-aged men as their leads.
Right.
So it's a great time. For the first time now, actors that used to be character actors are becoming lead actors in things.
Mm.
So people who would have played the dad, or people who would have played the quirky older best friend, are now leads in things.
Right.
You think of Bryan Cranston and Steve Buscemi and
great point.
You know, and Peter Dinklage, the great Peter Dinklage in our show, they're all men of a certain age who've got so much character about them and can bring so much of their worldly wise demeanor to these parts. It wouldn't work with younger men. They have to be that age, and they're the iconic characters of TV at the moment.
You know, that's a great point. How many seasons have you done?
We've done five.
And how many have you been on the show?
I've been on since the start.
Since right from the beginning?
Yeah, I came in kind of halfway through season one. It's interesting to see how it's grown, really.
Well, and that's half the beauty of this, is the character arc of Samuel started kind of like the high school nerd, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
And now going off to be a master.
Yeah.
He's basically a wizard.
And that's the lovely thing about having 10 hours a year with these characters, that the developments, the psychological and the kind of narrative developments, can be paced in a way that's organic. Mm-hmm. You know, people would think that, spoiler alert again, when Sam kills a White Walker in season 3, the received wisdom would be that after that he'd immediately grow and he'd immediately start walking around like Shaft. You know what I mean? He'd immediately start thinking of himself as something special. But in reality, psychology doesn't work like that. It takes people a lot longer to get over things.
To get that confidence.
It takes people a lot longer for their confidence and their character to really blossom. So the fact that we get so much time with them means that that can happen in a way that doesn't feel rushed, that feels faithful to you know,
the organic progression of this character.
Yeah.
And it's funny, right before you got here, there was a knock on the door, and before I could get up, the door opened, and I'm like, is he a wizard? Like, how did he open my door? And it was the maid checking to see if there was service. And then you came right after, but I was like, wow, he really is a wizard.
He really is.
Ish kabibble, open the door. You might not even know this, but what's the budget for an episode of Game of Thrones?
I'm not sure, really. I mean, it's when you see it, because when we start a new season, we have these we have premieres, and we normally show the first episode at these premieres, and you get to see it on huge screens. We've done it at Man's Chinese,
okay, like on the big screen,
on the biggest of big screens, and you find that it really does hold up and looks like a movie.
Oh, it does, and that's why I'm asking. It would seem like, you know, $5 million, $10 million budget, because there's so much going on.
It must be something like that, I think.
You think so? That's such an incredible amount of money to be spent on an episode of a TV show, but it's more than just that. But I was just thinking the risk that HBO took at first to make this show, because, I mean, the sets alone and the hundreds, I'm sure there's some CGI, but there's also, you got to have these guys in there to do the battles and all that other stuff as well.
Yeah, that's true. And also, they'd never done a fantasy series before, so that was enough of a gamble anyway. Will our audience, who are used to things like The Wire and Sopranos, will they buy this? Will they go for this? And it turns out they did, because I think the balance between those two things is just right. But the thing also, as you say, about a fantasy series is we can't just film it on the streets of Burbank.
Right, right.
You know, we can't do that. We have to find these immersive atmospheres, and we have to build. A lot of the sets are complete 360 builds. So they're just there.
So they're real, you know, fortresses of, you know, whatever it may be.
So the first time I walked into Castle Black on the first day of shooting, it was all there. It was a complete 360, a kind of immersive experience, and that can only help.
Oh yeah, that gets you into it, I'm sure.
We have to do some green screen as well for things that are just too kind of outlandish to shoot. But most of the time you're in the environment you're in. When we go to Iceland, we're feeling the cold. We're feeling minus 35 degrees sometimes, so it you can't help but immerse yourself in it when you're placed so in an environment that's so faithfully recreated.
It seems that most of your scenes are in the snow and in the cold and at night.
Yeah.
And that's probably not the easiest of conditions to be shooting in.
No, it's not. It's very tiring, actually. When we went to Iceland. I don't know if you've been to Iceland.
I have not. So that's where you film it, in Iceland?
We filmed summer season 2 and 3 in Iceland, and we got out there November, December. So not only is it incredibly cold, minus 35, as I said, some days, you only get like 4 or 5 hours daylight.
Right, because it gets dark so quickly.
It gets dark so quickly. So you have to. It's a very, very intense working day. But you can tell when you get there that it's just going to add so much texture to it. And there's very little CGI on those Iceland scenes. Most of it is on the screen as it was on the day. And there was a couple of times where, one springs to mind, where we couldn't actually get onto the location because the snow was so bad. They'd found a location for us to do this scene. And then they came back and said, the snow's so bad, all the roads are closed, we can't really get up there safely. So we were like, so what are we going to do? So we'll just try and find somewhere else. So they went out of the back of the hotel. We were literally walking 10, 20 yards, and they found this unbelievable, like, cliff face with all glaciered ice on it.
Oh,
it was
incredible.
So you know, and then you see that on the screen. That looks such a beautiful location. You think, how beautiful would the one that they were intending to use going to be? Well, that's just how much of an embarrassment of riches Iceland is as a landscape.
Just to go there.
You don't have to go far, A, before you find something beautiful, and also B, before you find somewhere that looks completely untouched by modern life at all. It looks now as it's looked for millions of years, and I think when you go to somewhere like that, you can really get a sense of history and the kind of.
And once again, because your show is so historical, it takes place hundreds of years ago.
Yeah.
You know, these locations existed.
Yeah, it helps if you can block out the modern world as much as you possibly can.
Is there someone off screen, like as soon as they all cut, that has a big, big jacket for you to put on?
Yeah, there is. There had to be, really.
Yeah.
I think that we'd like to consider ourselves to be quite tough and quite resilient, but you know, it's only when you realize that in England especially, we're so down the middle when it comes to weather. We never really have extremes either way, and if we do get extremes either way, the country just grinds to a halt.
Right, yeah.
We get a flurry of snow and no planes can take off, and if it gets too hot, we can't use a hose pipe anymore. You know what I mean? So when we were out in Iceland, we just thought, there's no way that I'm ever going to complain about the cold in England again. But I did.
Of course you do, yeah.
You do, because you can't take yourself back to how cold you were, but it was a shock to the system for us, put it that way.
Well, let's talk about how you got the part
of Samwell Tarly and Game of Thrones in the first place. It's been 6 seasons so far, and we'll do that. First, I want to tell everyone how I got my smooth, close shave today, the opposite of what you guys look like on Game of Thrones. You got some great beards going on there, some great, I love Jon Snow's got the 3-day growth at all times, the very chic beard, but if you want to have no beard, you use the clean, close shave provided to you by Harry's.com. Harry's.com was started by 2 regular guys who were tired of paying big bucks at the store for razors that were kept under lock and key. You know how that is at the drugstore, such an annoyance. These 2 guys knew that the high quality razors didn't have to be so expensive, so they created Harry's.com, and now they offer great blades that give you a close, comfortable shave for half the price you pay at the drugstore, right? I love Harry's razors. I'm actually using Harry's starter set I got in the mail. It's called the Truman. A great deal. For just $15, you get a razor handle, moisturizing shaving cream, and 3 of Harry's 5-blade German engineered razors. German engineering. I know that sounds technical. Germany just doesn't make awesomely engineered cars or great rock and roll bands. They make awesome razor blades as well. Harry's actually owns their own razor blade factory in Germany. The factory's been cranking out amazing high quality blades for over 90 years. Well crafted. These things shave you smoother than a baby's bottom. It really works. And because Harry's cuts out the middleman and sells their blades directly to you, they're able to offer such a low price and just even get lower. Because if you use my promo code Jericho, you get $5 off your first purchase. Use the promo code Jericho. Get $5 off at Harry's.com. That's HARRYS.com. Get the shave of your life thanks to Harry's.com.
It's your last chance to get great holiday savings at Guitar Center. Like a Yamaha F335 acoustic guitar, just $99. Or get a Luna Soprano ukulele, only $49. Plus the newest and hottest guitars, drums, keys, and more. Exclusive gear you can't get anywhere else. Special financing. Lessons for the beginner on your list. And gift cards, the perfect present for every musician. So hurry in and find your sound at Guitar Center.
How's it feel to be friends with the most hated man at Castle Black?
You were friends with me when I first came here, and I wasn't winning any elections back then.
It is to us then.
I'm here with John Bradley, a.k.a. Samwell Tarly, on Game of Thrones. It is back this Sunday, season 6 on HBO. How did you get the gig in the first place?
Well, it seemed like such a long time ago now. I went to drama school. I did 3 years of drama training in Manchester, which I loved, had a great time, and then came out, got my agent from that, and then this was the first thing I was put up for.
You're kidding me.
Yeah.
This was your first audition, basically.
My first audition, yeah, which looking back now, I'm sure that people now would be daunted to audition for Game of Thrones, but the fact was I was daunted just because it was my first audition.
Right.
And I probably would have been just as nervous no matter what it was. But the fact that it was the thing that got me so excited was it was an HBO thing, because I hadn't read the books. Mm-hmm. And I used to like fantasy when I was a kind of kid and early teenager, but I kind of drifted away from it a little bit. So I wasn't really...
What kind of fantasy did you like?
Well, I used to love sci-fi very much.
Certain movies or shows?
Yes, Star Wars.
Okay,
I was hugely into Star Wars.
Which would be like futuristic fantasy. Did you ever play Dungeons and Dragons or anything? Do you have that here, Dungeons
and
Dragons?
Yeah, we do. No, yeah. I was never quite into that. No, okay. it was always kind of forward-looking science fiction.
Right.
Once again, Star Wars is... A father and son relationship set on
absolutely another dysfunctional family.
Another dysfunctional family. So that all that's at the root of all good drama, be it fantasy or mm-hmm. or whatever. So the only thing I had to latch onto was the fact this is an HBO thing, and as soon as I knew it was HBO, that conjures up so many great images in a
just the name, the brand,
just
HBO,
the brand HBO.
Right?
I mean, if any kind of TV production company would have come up with Sopranos alone, they'd be kind of pleased with themselves.
Yeah.
But you look at some of the other stuff they've done and you think, oh God, I'd love to get the chance to work with them. And as soon as you know their name was behind it, you knew it was legit.
Mm-hmm.
Like you knew that this would feature people working at the very top of their game. And the fact that I even have the chance to go in front of these people and try and sell my wares is very humbling.
So did you have to come to London for that?
Yeah, I came to London. I came to London twice. And the first time I was just put on camera, the same as everybody is, which is a kind of... It was a strange experience for me anyway, because I went to such a theatrical theatre school. It was all mainly about live theatre. We did
like Shakespearean plays. And that
yeah,
sort of thing,
all yeah. the classics. So we did 3 hours of camera training in 3 years.
Hmm.
So it's not a lot. And I think that drama schools in England are looking forward now, and they do know the importance of training for camera. But back then, when I was there was very little. So I went into the audition and was put on camera. Didn't know whether to perform for the person in the room or for the camera.
Mm-hmm.
So, but no matter what I did, it seemed to work. And then I came for a recall and met Frank, the producer, and Dan, one of the showrunners. And it kind of went from there, really. But, yeah, it's strange to think I did 3 hours of camera training. And my fourth hour on camera was my first hour on Game of Thrones.
Let's talk a little bit, though, because this is something interesting that a lot of people don't realize. The difference between a live on stage performance and a performance for the camera.
Yeah.
What are some of the differences?
I think it's a slightly different feat of concentration. I think it's all about the concentration. The challenge in theater is to go on every night for a year, maybe, and say the lines as if you're saying them for the very first time,
mm-hmm.
which is a challenge, of course it is, and you need to really lock yourself into the machine of the performance in order to pull that off. The difference between that and acting for camera is when you're on a film set, you have to say it 40 times that day,
mm-hmm. right.
and still say it like you're saying it for the first time, even though you've literally said it 40 times in for so many different shots and so many different takes. So you have to keep your concentration up for that in a slightly different way. It's not about plotting a character's journey across 2 hours of a story. It's about plotting their journey across sometimes only 30 seconds of a scene.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to keep locked into it in order to keep hitting those notes every time. I mean, if you've got an emotional scene where, for example, you find out that, I don't know, find out that your wife's been cheating on you or something. So you have that to play. If you're doing it in a play across 2 hours, then you kind of live the emotional journey through that. You can remember 90 minutes ago when you were with your wife on stage and you were all in love.
Right.
And now you can follow that narrative through, and the psychological twists and turns are all very present. But when you're doing it for camera, of course, not only have you got to hit the same emotional notes 40 times that day, but you may not have even met the actress playing your wife yet.
Right. Or you may be shooting it out of context.
Shooting it completely out of context.
She might not even have cheated on you yet.
Maybe not cheating. You maybe have not even filmed the scenes where you're in love yet.
Right at the very
start of the movie when you're living this idealized life that all subsequently goes wrong. So they're just some of the differences. I think that it's mainly about, in film you have to be imaginatively more agile.
Mm-hmm.
You have to really throw yourself around emotionally and make sure that you can just drop yourself in at any point in the script. You have to have for both of them, you have to have a real understanding of the script, but you have to plot your way through a film script slightly differently. So you understand the character and his development and his motivation all the way through well enough that you could shoot the very last scene of the movie
first. Right.
Yeah.
I've found from The Wrestling Ring, which is, I always call it, it's a modern day Shakespearean play.
Yeah.
You are emoting to an arena of people, a stadium of people sometimes.
Yeah.
It has to be bigger motions, bigger movements. And you have to be able to turn that down to be very subtle at times, especially when you go in front of a camera when it's a backstage bit or
do
a movie or whatever it may be. But the live performance, the live reaction, the live gratification of whether they're laughing or whether they're, oh my goodness, all that comes into play as a live performer.
Well, it's interesting, though, because for you guys, you do have to, I mean, these are huge venues that you do this in. I mean, there's tens of thousands of people there.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to be big, and you have to play to the back row a lot of the time. But also, the challenge is that you're on camera as well for the screen.
Mm-hmm. Right, you're right. For the big screen.
Yeah. So you have to find the balance between those two things.
Yeah.
I've always found that very interesting.
There is a lot of similarities. That's why I wanted to ask you, because I have the same feelings about the live performance in comparison to a camera on camera backstage, or like I said, a movie or whatever. Because, you know, you shoot a TV show and you don't see it for 6 months.
Yeah, that's right.
So you don't know which take they're going to use, what's good, what's bad. Is this still funny after you've said it 5 or 6 times?
Yeah.
You know, you get a laugh the first time, but then, you know.
Comedy especially is very interesting. I've done little... This,
this. Well, Samwell is a very funny character within the confines of the Game of Thrones universe as well.
Yeah, it's a kind of candle in the darkness thing.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of a candle in the darkness is the brightest thing,
right?
But compared to
exactly, yeah.
But I mean one thing. It's kind of a cliche, really, but it's so true. If you're doing something that's comic on film, you find that the first time you show it to the crew, they may laugh.
Mm-hmm.
The second time you show it to the crew, they may laugh, but slightly less. Mm-hmm. And then after that, because they've heard it so many times, they've heard it 40 times, there's nothing.
You get nothing.
You're flatlining every single time you say it. So the temptation then is to say, oh, no, they're not laughing anymore. Mm-hmm. I need to push it. I need to come up with something else. I need to change it in a way that's going to surprise them. But the more you do that, the more you get away from what was funny in the first place.
Right.
So you just have to trust that the audience are only going to see it once.
Mm-hmm.
No matter how many times you do it on the day, the take that they pick is all that the audience is ever going to experience of it.
Yes.
Which is why you have to be faithful in every take to what the director wants and what you want long term.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're giving an audience one chance to watch this, one shot, and so you have to...
Right, so your timing and your delivery has to be the same.
Yeah.
Basically every time.
Yeah.
To get the optimum reaction.
And trust the edit as well.
Right.
Trust that the guys in the edit room and the director and the producers who were there during the edit, trust that that you're in good hands with them. Because you most of the time are, because they want to use the best tape because it's their, they've got their name on it.
Sure, yeah. So they want to pop it as well.
So it's just a case of you give them what they want on the day, then you have to hand it over to them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You have to say, I trust you with this to make of this what you will. And
right.
And the good thing about Thrones especially is that the guys, David and Dan, the execs, they've made it feel like a collaboration from day one.
Mm.
So there's a scene in my first episode in season one where John and Sam are cleaning tables and they're discussing women. They're discussing being virgins and they're discussing how come they've never had sex with women and stuff. That scene wasn't in the original draft.
Mm.
That scene was written much later when they saw the relationship that was starting to develop between me and Kit Harington. He plays
right.
John. So they saw that very quickly. It's the same with me and Andy and me and Ben. You know, it's just a very immediate chemistry that happened where we started to, you know, react to each other. We started to relate to each other in this way. And then they were sensitive enough to spot that and say, oh, we're going to use this relationship or parts of this relationship for the Sam and John relationship because it feels organic. We can see that there's a trust developing. So they wrote that scene out of that real-life relationship, which once you know that you've got producers and writers, you've got your best interests at heart, mm-hmm. and they know what you are, know what kind of actor you are, and will start to write to your strengths. That's when you feel really supported.
And that's going to happen, as we were talking about earlier, especially when you spend so much time together with the guys in your crew. You're going to become friends, if, you know, just from the fact that you're sitting in minus 35 weather for months on end.
Yeah.
That's a connection that no one else will ever get.
That's the thing, but I just, because I had a great relationship with Kit, and that was the first kind of professional relationship I ever had because it was the first thing I did. The fact that we have a good relationship means now that I assume I'm going to make a new best friend on everything.
Yeah, right.
You know, and I may not. I've been very lucky, as I say, right up until recently with Andy and Ben.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that's not to, you know, disparage or say anything about the other guys in the movie because they're all great. We were all friends.
But there's chemistry, like you said, somebody you really, really jibe with.
Yeah, and the conversation becomes easy. There's a great, I can't remember where it's from, and I'm going to paraphrase horribly here, about there were two guys fishing. People can Google this if they don't quite know the thing. Two guys fishing, and they were together in out in the highland somewhere, and then they realized at that point they were best friends because they realized they didn't have to talk to each other.
Ah, right.
That there's an ease to it. There's an ease to genuine friendship and genuine chemistry, which means you don't always have to be... You don't always have to be on. You don't always have to be bringing
saying something.
You don't always have to be bringing something to the table.
Mm-hmm.
It's just about being with somebody, which is a very comforting thing. And I find that the real chemistry comes from being relaxed, and that helps with the on-screen work as well, because it's the same. It's hugely magnified when it comes to your job. It's just all about trust.
Absolutely, yeah.
You just have to trust each other. You have to say that. in a slightly less extreme case with us, because it's only acting and it's only artistic. But still,
there is some trust, like you said, and I always find when you actually do have a relationship with someone, when you legitimately like each other,
yeah,
you always work harder. Not that you don't work hard, but you always want it to be better because it's your friend.
It's true.
You know what I mean?
And you can also play scenes of antagonism between two people if you really get on with them as well. In fact, it's better because you feel more comfortable displaying it.
Yeah.
And you know there's an understanding that it's only work and we really do like each other.
Mm-hmm.
And having said that, I'm going to really rip into you now because I know that we're both comfortable with it and I know that we both support each other. So it just helps. If you think if I fall you're going to catch me, that's kind of all the hard work done, really.
Now, you mentioned that you hadn't read the books. I haven't read the books either.
Yeah.
Just watched every episode, but the books don't mirror completely the show, right?
No, well, I have read the books now.
Now,
but
at first you didn't,
not cover to cover, but kind of. You know,
is it mirroring what's going on the show, or are they changing it?
They have to. They have to, well, because the books are huge and that we've only got 10 hours of show, some things have to be cut and some things have to be, you know, slapped together and conflated a little bit. And it can't be that faithful just because David and Dan, when they start a new season, apart from all the artistic decisions they've got to make, they've got a huge mathematical problem in terms of we've got 10 hours. We've got all of these characters, and we have to make sure that we give them time enough to have a satisfying narrative arc across 10 episodes. So their main problem is all maths. It's about we'll give this many minutes to him in this episode, this many minutes to him, and then we'll leave him out for a few, but then give him a few minutes here. So it's all about making sure that these stories are nicely tied up across 10 hours. But having said that, the books have got so much detail to them, and they're so tangential and...
Good word. And
thanks. And they're kind of verbose in a way, in the way that they describe things, sensual things. We haven't got the room to describe that. We have to show that as a clear visual image in a couple of seconds. So stuff has to be dropped and stuff has to be changed around a little bit. And that's why I always say it's probably best not to read too far ahead in the books, because as an actor, you'll read ahead in the books, you'll come across something that you really like, that happens to your character in the future, in the books. You'll have your heart set on it, and then when it comes to the time, for time reasons, it just goes.
It won't happen.
It just won't happen. So you've been posing in front of the mirror for months, getting it right, and it's not even going to be there. So,
does it go that way for characters dying as well? Are there characters that die on the show that haven't died in the books, or vice versa?
And not really major characters,
no. Okay, because I know Walking Dead does that. They'll mess with it to keep the fans on their toes.
I think that now the show's... this season, especially, the show is beyond the books. Season six, yeah. So we've got as far as the books have gone in terms of source material, and now we're out on a limb.
So nobody knows what's going to happen.
What's going to happen, and... You know, don't be surprised if what you see in the next season isn't in the next book.
Mm-hmm.
It's not really about we're now overtaking the books and the books now have to catch up.
Right, Miller's going
to
do what he wants to do.
They may just split up a little bit, which is fine because people trust the show and people like the show. And also, crucially, George R. R. Martin, who writes the books, he's an executive producer on the show. He writes the odd episode. He's very much involved. So anything that happens going forward isn't going to happen without his blessing. It's not like...
So he still has to approve what's going to happen.
It's not like David and Dan have wrestled the books from his grasp and now have carte blanche to do whatever they want with it. It's just
still his, yeah.
Yeah, with his intentions, or change his intentions in any way. Anything that happens will happen for the good of the show. And they might be slightly different for the good of the books, but now people trust the show in and of itself that they'll go along with it, I think.
Do you get the scripts, like all 10 scripts at once, or is it a weekly thing? Like, here's your script for this week, and then here's your script for next week?
Usually a couple of months before we start shooting, they dribble through. We normally get them in three blocks, which is a very, very exciting time, especially this year when... We
can't look at the book.
We can't even look at the book to find out what's going to happen. So this year, yeah, it all became very, very exciting finding out what happens to people. And because the way the show's set out, there's so much of the show that we're not involved in as actors. So we're involved in 10% of it, and 90% of it is different storylines.
Sure, some people you've never even done scenes with.
Never done
the majority of the crew.
Most people, I've never done scenes with
the cast.
So just to find out what happens to them, I stopped reading other people's scenes. A couple of years ago, just because I wanted to see it.
What happens?
I wanted to watch naturally. It as a viewer, the way we can do, because we have nothing to do with their storyline, apart from in some kind of vague way, all for the greater good and stuff. The fact that we don't have anything to do with that story means I wanted to watch it.
Yeah.
I wanted to see it like everybody else
wants
to see it.
See it unfold the way the director and producers intended to be.
Yeah, that's in... Yeah, but one thing I found when I was reading it was, even though you know what's going to happen plot-wise and narratively, you read some of the stage directions in the scripts and you think, God, I don't know how they're going to film this. I just don't know how they're going to get it together. I don't know how they've got the budget. I don't know how they've got the time. And what happens every year is you find that they do the impossible and they manage to film what appears to be unfilmable on paper.
Right.
So that was a certain thrill in that as well, seeing that you see the words and it's ink on paper and it takes a second to write down this stage direction, but then it seems impossible. You give it to the director, you give it to the actors and the amazing art and design team that we've got on it, the VFX guys. And then you see it and you see it come to life. It must be how George feels all the time.
When he's writing it.
When he sees the show, it must be the kind of, oh God, something that I think he wrote the first book in 1991. So that's, you know, 20, 25 years ago. Something that I wrote 25 years ago is now being made visually real.
Yeah.
It must be a real thrill.
Yeah. No, I want to talk about one of my favorite Game of Thrones scenes involving you and the terrifying White Walkers. But before we do that, I got to take a minute to thank the sponsors who support this podcast, including Works Switch Driver. Okay, you can become a do-it-yourselfer around the house thanks to this handy tool. You know, Samwell would have loved to have had one of these in Game of Thrones times to build houses and stuff, whatever the heck Samwell would build. But I'm telling you, you can become a do-it-yourselfer around the house thanks to this handy tool, around the castle, around Castle Winterfell. The Works Switch Driver is a power tool that lets you drill a hole and drive the screw with one tool, all right? The Works Switch Driver makes all those projects around your house easy to get done. You wouldn't believe the little things I'm able to do when I'm home now. I built a catapult with ash the other day. I can fix stuff around the house. I hang some pictures on my daughter's wall. You can install storage shelves. I replaced a drawer, the drawer in my outside patio. All kinds of stuff that I've been putting off doing because I'm a horrible fix-it-up man. But I have now the Excalibur of fix-it-up tools, the Works Switch Driver. It's changed everything for me. I'm getting stuff done, spending valuable time with the family. That's the beauty of the Works Switch Driver. You get things done so much quicker. And the Switch Driver is cordless, so I didn't get tangled up in the cord. Didn't have to worry about someone tripping over the cord, pulling out of the socket while I was drilling. Switch Driver is powered by a 20-volt max lithium battery and has a 2-speed gear, okay? The dual checks... The dual chucks. They let you rotate from drill to driver without changing bits. That really works, so you can get your work done twice as fast. This is the one power tool you absolutely need to have. Double your power, save time. What's not to love? All right. And right now, if you go to WorksSwitchDriver.com, that's W-O-R-X, SwitchDriver.com, enter promo code Chris at checkout, you'll receive free shipping and 10% off your order. That's Works Switch Driver, Works, W-O-R-X, SwitchDriver.com. Use the promo code Chris to get free shipping and 10% off. All right. WorksSwitchDriver.com. Use the promo code Chris. Become the handyman that you always knew you could be. All right, we're talking Game of Thrones with John Bradley, a.k.a. Samwell Tarly, on the show. The new season six, starts this Sunday on HBO. And you know we're going to talk about the White Walkers and what it takes to film them. They're so creepy. And film with them, which is even creepier. But first, I got to tell you about some very cool and easy ways that you can make some extra cash. I'm telling you, drive with Uber. All right. I know everyone needs a little extra sometimes, so why not earn some driving your own car and work in the hours that fit best for your schedule? All right. Driving with Uber is totally flexible. You don't have to quit your day job to do it. No. Whenever you want to pick up some extra cash, just turn on the app and drive. You can drive for a few hours here, a few hours there, a ride or two here and there. It all adds up fast. Really easy to get started. This is all you got to do. First, go to drivewithuber.com to sign up for free. You can do that right now on your smartphone. Secondly, answer a few basic questions about you and your car and then get approved. Third, start driving. So that's it. That easy. Start enjoying the flexibility of working when you want, how you want, how much time you want, earning extra money on your schedule. And who knows? Maybe I'll be the one getting in your car one day. I used Uber in London. They got Uber in London. I use Uber when I'm on the road with the WWE, traveling around the world. It's the easiest way to get around. Perfect, low hassle transportation. Do it, man. You want to make some extra bucks?
put your extra hours to use. Sign up with Drive with Uber today. Go to drivewithuber.com. That's drivewithuber.com and be your own boss. Don't miss out. All right, let's get back to John Bradley from Game of Thrones.
Let's talk about one of my favorite Samuel scenes is when you mentioned the White Walkers. It's yeah. the classic scene.
Yeah.
First of all, how did you film that? And second of all, I have a question as to why did the White Walker just look at you, look at Sam, and just move on?
Well, that's an interesting point. That's not really been explained properly. I think people have argued for a long time about what that means. Maybe he could sense the dragonglass, because dragonglass is the only thing that can.
Because you already had the dragonglass.
Yeah, I already had it by that
time. You found it.
Yeah.
The dragonglass can kill the White Walker.
Yeah, that was before that. He found a stash of dragonglass before that, and then there was the White Walker attack at the end of season two. So maybe the White Walker could.
So you're never told these sort of things.
No, never told these. But I think that's good that it's not made explicit to us, because if you want it to be ambiguous, you can't have an actor oversell it.
Yeah, you know what I mean? It was funny because I went and Googled it afterwards. Like, yeah. I'm trying to, maybe I missed something because there's so much happening.
Yeah.
Actually, Roman Reigns and I discussed Game of Thrones at length, and he went and watched it a couple times. Roman Reigns is our champion.
Yeah, right.
And he's watched it a couple times because there's so many names and so much thrown at you that you really have to watch it a few times.
Yeah.
So I Googled it to see, and one of the explanations was that maybe Sam is, kind of weak. Timid,
yeah.
And the White Walker was just like, if you were going to kill, a bunch of hamsters and there's one of them that's lame with three legs, you're like, oh, this one's had a tough enough life as it is, I'll just leave it alone.
It could be that as well.
That was another one, because he was so timid at that point in time.
That's right.
Terrified.
It could be that as well.
You never know.
It could be kind of any of these things. The great thing about TV, and especially TV of this type, it does give a lot of people room to speculate a lot
sure.
of the time. And I think that's part of the fun. That's why there's a lot of, fan websites and things like that dedicated to it. The fact that the speculation and all the peripheral kind of whys and wherefores around the main body of the show, that's part of the fun for people. So it's best not to kind of spot. It's like the end of The Sopranos, where people didn't know if Tony had died or not. I spoiler again. You should have watched it by now, though, really.
Yeah.
But
10 years ago.
10 years
ago. I think the statute of spoiler limitations has run out.
Yeah, completely. Can't get me on that
yeah,
one.
Yeah.
But, and I think that it actually has been explained, and the showrunner has explained exactly what happened. But, I'd rather not know.
Well, it's the same like, Pulp Fiction. What was in Marcellus Wallace's case?
Yeah, completely.
The guys were killing people for and had that bright light in it.
Yeah.
No one ever really knows for sure, and there's so many different theories about it.
Yeah.
Which makes it even more mysterious and more cool, in my opinion.
Yeah, completely. I think that it comes from the best place when you can sense that the people who made the show knew what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's been done deliberately. It's been done for a reason. It's not the fact they didn't know. They do know, but they don't want
you
to
know. They left it ambiguous on purpose.
On purpose, and I think that's the one that's most effective.
How did you film that scene? Was there a lot of were you just looking at a blank space, or was there a guy walking with a cloak on? Or
yeah, there was literally a guy walking with a huge wooden pole
mm-hmm.
with a green spot on the top of it, which was supposed to be. The White Walker's face. So as long as I'm looking at that, I'm looking at his face. But a lot of people think that the White Walker, who the actor and the costume is the same White Walker that was killed in season three later on. A lot of people think that's a lot of CGI.
Hmm.
That it's a CGI created monster, but that's purely prosthetic.
Oh, it's actually a real guy.
He's actually a real guy in a real latex suit.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And that's when you really see the craft in a lot of the people's work on this show. When you can get something that's real, but people think it looks too good to be real and it must be fake.
Yeah.
But that all adds to it, because there's a scene later on where, just before I kill the White Walker it's a scene in the forest.
The forest.
The guy was there, Ross, who's Ross Mullen, who's an expert at these things. He's an expert in animalistic body movement and he's an incredible acrobatic performer. We were doing the scene and he's walking towards me and you can see him coming through the trees in costume. And you just get flashes of him in the darkness, just this skeletal face coming at you through the darkness. And you think, oh, God, I bet this is going to look cool.
Yeah.
And I mean, just because I was there and I could see it without any tiny touches of CGI that were added later,
right.
I could see it on the day and it looked pretty cool.
Yeah, or the shading of the lighting you see live. Yeah,
everything, every single pixel, every single square inch of that screen has been thought about by somebody. Just in terms of lighting decisions, in terms of camera placement, it's all been thought about. But even when you see it in real life and it's pretty cool, you know it's going to be something impressive. Yeah.
I did a movie. There's this popular series of really campy movies called Sharknado.
Yeah.
In the state. I did three last year, and I got eaten by a shark on a roller coaster.
Yeah.
I was a roller coaster attendant. So when you get eaten by, like, they thrash back and forth and scream and go thrash, thrash, thrash. And I give myself a headache from just moving over and over, take. And then when you see it with the CGI shark, it looks really cool.
It makes sense.
And it just looks, and like, what an amazing like transformation from, like you said, there's nothing here, and then suddenly you have this giant shark eating you.
Yeah.
That must have been kind of cool for you, the same way with the White Walkers, when they're all just walking by you when you were just looking at a pole with a light on top of it.
I know. But you know? So much of acting, and it's been the case ever since I first started at drama school, if you take acting and look at it objectively, it's ludicrous. A lot of the stuff you're asked to do is ludicrous.
Yeah, right.
It's a ludicrous job. It's a luxury job. It's not a job that really affects people.
Mm-hmm.
Actors could be wiped from the face of the earth and everything and still carry on just fine.
Yeah.
So you're asked to do some pretty extreme and some quite silly things, but they're only silly out of context. If you buy into the context of the show, buy into the context of the life of the character that you're playing, they make perfect sense.
Yeah. That's acting.
As long as you commit to it. Somebody once said to me at drama school, and it's a great way of simplifying acting. Acting is responding to fake stimulus with genuine emotion.
Mm. Great quote.
Which is a really, really, really good, nice kind of reductive in a good way looking at it.
Yeah.
But then again, it takes an imaginative leap, and it's the same with CGI. You have to trust the guys who come and do their work later.
Let those professionals do their job.
Yeah, and you've got to commit to it as much as they do. Mate, if it starts to feel silly for 1 second, or if it starts to feel slightly ludicrous and that you're slightly in an uncomfortable place where you feel a bit stupid, then that's when you need to have a think, you know, you have to commit to this, because people are going to come along later who are going to commit to it too with their art. And you have to commit to it fully and meet halfway to create these moments.
That's a great point.
Yeah,
you know, I saw Roger Waters do The Wall a few years ago.
Oh my God, yeah.
So, I mean, the music is genius.
Yeah.
But then the set construction and the lighting and the sound and the computer graphics, you have probably half a dozen geniuses all doing their job to make this production. And what you just said translates. It's like you have to let everyone do their job and trust that they're going to be committed as much as you as a performer.
I'd love to see The Wall.
It's great. If you ever get a chance.
I'd love to. I saw David Gilmour at the Hollywood Bowl a couple of weeks ago.
No kidding.
Yeah. Right, it was incredible.
Yeah, he does a lot of Floyd stuff still too, right?
Yeah, he does. Yeah. I mean, it was there was the obligatory couple of tracks off the new album, which is great as well, by the way. But there was something about hearing that voice.
Yeah.
There's something about hearing the voice.
Yeah.
And hearing that, because he's a musical scientist almost, David
Gilmour.
That's
a good point, yeah.
In terms of using all of, he's very tech savvy.
Yes.
And he uses a lot of different, probably hugely expensive equipment to create exactly the same.
Yeah, the right tones.
Exactly the right tone that you hear on the record. Mm-hmm. And the Hollywood Bowl as well, which is a huge venue.
Massive place.
And acoustically can be tricky.
Yeah.
He managed to fill it with this incredible sound. And that's when you see craftsmen. And you see people like him. And you see people like McCartney as well, who I unfashionably love.
Oh, me too.
And you see them and you think they don't need to work anymore, but they're still striving for something.
But I love, and the same with the Stones. It's like, why do they do this? They don't need the money. It's not about the money.
No, it's not.
If you do anything, and the same as for you acting, like you just mentioned before, you're doing other movies and other shows. Whether you're making scale or whether you're making $10 million, it's to expand your creativity.
Completely. And the Stones always put songs into the live set list that people don't know so well.
Well, McCartney too. He's opening with Hard Day's Night now.
They've
never played it live.
It's amazing.
I just saw that the other night. I was looking at the set list. I'm a big go and see. Like, yeah. Oh, what's the set? I couldn't believe it. There's a bunch of tunes on there like that. There's like What else was he playing? Temporary Secretary.
Yeah, I
just really weird tunes like that.
The first time he ever played Temporary Secretary was at the O2 here last year, and I was there.
It's like, talk about like the most obscure of McCartney tunes.
Yeah, I love that tune though.
It's great, but I mean, would you ever expect him to play that?
No, you wouldn't.
You know,
and that's pure McCartney in a way, because I think McCartney's been often unfairly derided as playing it safe. I don't think he ever plays it safe. I think he's such an innovative
artist. People forget that.
Yeah, I know.
Because you take a song like Band on the Run, which is such a staple, there's like 5 tempo changes. That song doesn't make any sense.
No, it doesn't.
It just, like, you know, the Beatles material, it goes into a lot of that Wing stuff.
Yeah.
People forget, like, this guy is in left field musically.
Oh, completely.
But because he's so good and there's so many hooks and harmonies and melodies,
yeah,
you just accept it.
Yeah, you do.
Right?
And even in a song like Temporary Secretary, which is basically a techno, I think it's like 3 seconds of techno, mm-hmm, that's just on a constant loop.
Yeah, yeah.
He can't help but put a melody into it.
Yeah.
He sings a melody, like a singable melody. He's a melodic genius, and he just one of those guys that can just seem to pull melodies out of thin air.
Well, and that's the brilliance of it.
Yeah,
and like you said, that's why he still does it.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, you mentioned seeing Gilmore at the Hollywood Bowl. Was the first time you ever went to L.A. because of Game of Thrones, or had you gone out there before?
I went out for the Emmys in, I think, 2012. That was the first time I'd ever been to America. And it's interesting going to America, because you find that because we film in Belfast, and it's mainly in Belfast, I should say, and it's got a local crew and there's lots of UK actors in it, you can forget that you're part of this American thing.
Mm-hmm. The show's an American show.
It's an American show. It's got American masterminds, crucially American money, and HBO, which is this incredible American platform for us to tell the story on. You can forget that when you're just in Belfast with a couple of English actors.
Yeah.
But it's only when you go over there and you see the response to it over there. They're so forthcoming. It's like we had our premiere on Sunday of last week, and they cordoned off half of Hollywood Boulevard, and there were people strewn across the street.
It's huge.
They must have been waiting for hours, and it's interesting to take it home in a way. It's like McCartney playing Liverpool, mm-hmm, you know what I mean? Taking Game of Thrones, which goes all over Europe to make it, and we send it back to them and see what they think of it, and they seem to love it.
Is that when you realized how big Game of Thrones was when you went to the Emmys, or was it pretty quickly into the first season, or was it the second season where it became huge, or was it instantly?
Yeah, the build-up to the second season was when I think we knew that we had a hit. Because, crucially, and I've said this before, but I think it's so true, it's not up to us to make a big show. It's not up to the actors to make a big show. It's up to the actors to make a good show, which then becomes big if it's good enough.
Right.
We can't be on set thinking of how it's going to be marketed or how it's going to tie
That's
in.
That's not your job.
It's not our job. Well, we can't be thinking of the billboards. We can't be thinking of the tie-in merchandise.
Mm-hmm.
All we've got to be thinking is we want to justify how big it gets by making it good in the first place.
Right.
I think that's quite crucial.
What about the fan base? Because I notice there's three fans, like wrestling fans,
yeah,
Kiss fans, and sci-fi fans,
yeah,
are insane.
Completely.
You know, love everything, hate everything, super technical and details, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
What's the fan reaction for you? I'm sure you've done signings, Comic-Cons, that sort of thing.
Yeah, they're really passionate about it. But that we were lucky in the first place, because when you start any new series, you have to try and find an audience. You have to put it out there and have faith that enough people will latch onto it, that it becomes a success.
Right.
But with Game of Thrones, because it was based on these series of books that are already hugely popular,
yeah,
we had a huge audience already in place who were going to watch it because they love the books.
Mm-hmm.
But what you have then is you have a solution to a problem that creates a new problem, because we've got an audience there who are going to watch it, but also we've got an audience there to potentially really piss off if we don't get it right.
Yeah. It's so into every single detail about the show and every single moment and just analyzing everything. Do you get those type of people too?
Fans? Yeah, I've had that a few times. And I've told this story before, but it's a real favorite because it says a lot about the mindset of some of the people who watch the show. I was in London not so long ago, and a guy comes up, and he was very respectful. He was just a nice, intelligent-looking guy. And he says, "I really love the show. Can I ask you a question?" And I said, "Yeah, of course, ask away." He says, "Okay." He says, I've watched the show for a long time, and I've just got one question. Why are you still so fat? I went, sorry? Why are you still so fat in the show? Why is Sam still so fat? Why is Sam still so fat? And so I said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, look, he's been walking across ice plains. He's not been eating. He's been on the run from ice zombies for a long time. He'd be shedding the pounds a little bit. They would be coming off. And I thought, it's strange, really, the fact that, you know, this is a fantasy show. It's a nailed-to-the-mast fantasy show with dragons and women giving birth to clouds and people who can be brought back to life by,
right, but...
by a snow zombie. And me being fat is the one thing about it that he just didn't buy.
That's the one acceptable thing.
That's the one thing where they just took the fantasy elements a little bit too far for this guy.
You got to love that sort of attitude, right?
Yeah, you've got to, and it's kind of, but you know, the fact is, and you probably know this, the fact is that there's a lot of guys on this show who are incredibly ripped and muscle-bound.
Right.
Who aren't eating either. You know what I mean? They're not getting the protein they need to bulk up to that size.
Exactly.
Yeah, so if you look at it from a purely biological standpoint, none of it, a lot of it doesn't work.
Really makes sense.
But yeah, you just got to buy into it because you know, certain things have a certain dramatic weight to them.
Whenever people say something like, why would this happen in wrestling? I say, listen, why, if I throw someone to the ropes, do they hit them and run back at me?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's like, yeah, that's like the most basic element of wrestling, which is throw someone to the ropes. I'll hang on to the ropes and just leave.
Yeah,
so
I know.
You just got to work with me here sometimes.
Yeah, exactly. Just gotta meet me halfway, and we should have a mutually satisfying experience.
Right. You mentioned before being so tight with Kit.
Yeah.
How was it for you when Jon Snow died? Which, you know, and then this is not wrestling, whether it's a secret or not, at the end of the last episode, he died.
Yeah.
And so, as far as I know, as a fan, he's dead.
Completely, yeah.
How was that for you as a fan of the show and also as a good friend of Kit?
Well, we always have this double whammy of grief when it, as a cast, whenever somebody goes, because we all love the show as well, and I'm a huge fan of everybody in it. So whenever somebody goes, you're saying goodbye to the character that you love and that you've watched and followed, but you're also saying goodbye to the actor as well, who's become a great friend. So you're seeing two people disappear in a way.
Right.
You're seeing the character and the actor. But it was hard with Kit because, as I said earlier on, it was the first professional relationship I ever had. He was the first person I ever acted with professionally. And it was nice to go away and do our own thing, but it was always nice to come back together. And it was just like putting on a comfortable pair of jeans, you know. Our relationship always clicked back in. We found the chemistry on screen very quickly. And it was hard to think that I'd be without that because, you know, as we've also said, that it's such a great luxury working with friends. And not only with friends, working with one of your best friends in the whole world. And I got to work with him on occasions, and that made it so much easier. It was such a dream working with him, and because I got to hang out with him as well. And it was just hard to accept that he's gone, because we're quite closely associated with each other.
Yeah.
Those characters are really associated with
each other. You're the closest two characters on the show that don't hate each other, as far as I can think.
I know, there's always a warmth when you see those two characters together. And without that, you're just worried that maybe that element is going to be missing, but it's certainly a big element that's going to be missing from my professional career, not having it, not banking on being able to see him every July till Christmas. But you know, I'm very close with Hannah Murray as well, who plays Gilly. We've got a really nice relationship as well. So yeah, we're really good friends, and it's always great to see her. So I'm not saying that I'm completely unhappy now that I'm not working with Kit anymore, but you know, it's just chapters close in your life, and our professional relationship is a chapter that's just closed, sadly.
I know with The Walking Dead, I had Josh McDermott, who plays Eugene, on, and they said that they have death dinners.
Yeah.
When somebody dies, they go out for one last, you know, hurrah. Did you guys do something like that?
Yeah, well, yeah, it's always really sad, but I think that people are just so proud of the show and so proud to have been a part of it that nobody necessarily wants to go, but they know sometimes that big deaths are what people remember about this show.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you think of Ned Stark, you think of the Red Wedding, you think of all of these, you think of Joffrey.
Gosh.
When characters go, major characters go, it tends to be memorable. And I think as actors, we trust David and Dan, we trust our directors, we trust each other as actors, that when our final scene finally comes, that it's going to be a satisfying one and a memorable one, and they're going to do the character justice, and I think they always have.
How about the cat who tried to kill the mountain, and he was dancing around him, and then he flipped him down and
I know.
Crushed his head.
There you go. I mean,
that was a good one.
That season, season four, I think that was, Pedro Pascal came in as the Red Viper and stole that season.
Mm-hmm.
He was incredible in that season. And he was so incredible in it and made such an impact on the show that you forget that he was only around for
eight, nine episodes,
yeah, something like right. that, at the very most.
Right.
And so that's what's great about this show for an actor. You can create quite a lot of impact very quickly
mm-hmm.
because of the material that you've got to work with, the character that you've got to that you get to perform. You don't need a lot of time in the show to be completely memorable, because the show's always creating these iconic images that seem to burn onto people's
right.
consciousnesses. And you only have to be in a couple of episodes to make that happen. But Pedro was a perfect example of somebody who just took the bull by the horns, created this incredible character, and in such a short space of time is now forever closely associated.
One of the most memorable scenes.
Yeah, one of the most memorable characters.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he will forever be in the firmament of the show, but he's not needed five seasons to do
yeah,
it.
Yeah,
the characters are so well formed and so well written and you know interpreted so brilliantly by certain actors that you can create an impact very quickly on that show, I think.
Was there some choices that you made to play Sam that weren't necessarily in the book or the script?
Yeah, I decided to play Sam with at the start especially, but it's kind of flattened out now as his character's changed. I always tried to play him with a stutter.
Yeah, yeah.
Like a slight stutter. So just when he's about to say something, you get the first sound of the word. And then he stops himself and then he starts again. And I think my kind of... And it was in his walk as well. He's got a kind of stuttering walk. He's not fluid in his movement and he's not fluid in his speech. And I decided that what's going on in Sam's mind... Because Sam's mind... The reason that Sam's mind is so developed and so active is because he's constantly talking himself out of doing things. So we'll start to speak, and then his internal monologue will go, oh, no, don't say that.
Hmm.
Oh, no, I will say that. Oh, no, don't say that. So he's so unsure of himself, he never quite knows whether to act or not. So this stuttering and this jerky kind of backwards and forwards movement and the false start to words and not quite completing sentences and the words landing in a strange place, that was all to do with him not being quite sure whether to speak or not. Because he was... been told constantly ever since birth that he shouldn't be seen or heard. He was an embarrassment and he should just crawl away to a little corner somewhere and not get in anybody's way because he's a severe embarrassment and the less that the father sees of him, the better. So when you have somebody with that psychology, they'll never be allowed to blossom because they've got so much crippling doubt about themselves. And that was my lead into that little stutter that he's always unsure whether to act or not. He's always unsure about what he's doing is right.
It's a great choice because I always took it like he was just, like you said, had no confidence.
Yeah.
Intimidated by all these great warriors.
Yeah.
And he's thinking that he doesn't belong. He's just a piece of shit.
And that's the thing about Sam. As soon as you start to get to know him, you always see that he's got so much more worth than he thinks he has.
Mm-hmm.
He's always the last person to admit that he's any good at all.
Right.
And those choices feed into that about so much in Sam's life has been unsaid because he's not got the courage to say things or do things.
Mm-hmm.
But there's sometimes when you do see that when he does act and when he does act out of instinct, he's on the money quite a lot of the time and he does say a lot of worthwhile things and he does a lot of worthwhile things. So the great tragedy in him is think of all the things that he could have said and done if only he hadn't have talked himself out of it.
How old is the Sam character?
He was 18 when the show started. But that's the thing, when the narrative of the show is a little bit undetermined, really, in terms of in terms of the amount of time between season one and six. Nobody's really sure of how...
Is it 6 years or 6 weeks or 6 months?
That's the thing. It seems to be different. It seems to be different from character to character, from storyline to storyline almost. But if we take him as 18 when the show started, it's probably not... It's not 6 years.
Early 20s, yeah.
Yeah, something like that, yeah. A
couple quick predictions I don't want you to answer, but I just have to say for the record. I'm not even going to look at you when I say them. First of all, this season, Sam will become a badass. I think it's the great transition, like you mentioned, Walter White, where he started this timid loser and then becomes this evil drug lord. I don't think Sam's going to be evil, but I think he's going to turn into a badass. And I think Jon Snow will get resurrected by the witch. Because Jon Snow, like, I was so sad when he died, because he's my favorite guy. So, you know, it'd be like if Daryl died on Walking Dead. Not that he couldn't, but that's just my prediction. I think he'll come back. So,
it's interesting with a lot of the deaths in TV drama, especially, people refuse to believe that they're real.
Yeah, you're right.
It's like, spoiler alert again, it's like when Stringer Bell died in The Wire.
Yeah.
I just thought a character that big can't go. But but you know what? These shows prove that life is temporary.
Well, and that's what I love, because anybody can die at any time. So we hear it all the time. Oh, so-and-so died. And you're just like, oh, man.
Yeah.
You know, that could happen.
It's the old thing. Another thing that I heard at school, which is probably a famous thing. You know, if you were to draw a line in the sand to represent your life, the one thing you don't know is where you are on the line at the moment.
Oh, right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that's an interesting thing about the way that deaths are represented in TV, the fact that people are alive right up until they're dead. So there's no foreshadowing a lot. Life can be just snuffed out. And, and it's part of that denial that people feel about death in real life. But you see, you're onto a winner when it's like an actor. People can have that genuine emotional response.
Are you discussing it? Yeah.
Even though it's fake stimuli, they can have the genuine emotional response.
It's the same as wrestling. I mean, fake is not a good word for wrestling, but it's a show. It's predetermined.
Yeah,
when something happens, when someone wins or loses, people will debate that until the proverbial cows come home.
Yeah.
Guys, it's a show.
I know.
This guy should have won. This guy should have won. This guy lost. Blah, 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 blah. It's a show.
Yeah.
You know, well, you should never have done that. Listen, if I show up for a Steven Spielberg movie and it calls for my character to die on page 3, I don't go, well, this isn't going to work for me, because you know what's going to happen? Steve's going to go off and bring somebody else in and die on page 3.
I know.
That's how it works.
Yeah. But in terms of the whole, which is what I find, I was a huge fan of WWF / E. The first record I ever bought was, you won't believe me, but it was. The first record I ever bought was WWF The Music, Volume 4.
Oh, yeah?
That was the first album I ever bought.
Who was on that one?
You were on it.
Okay, is it with the green cover?
Yeah, the green cover.
That
was
nice.
The first record I ever bought. So I was such a huge fan. And now that I know a little bit more about form and structure and narrative, I realize that every time you guys go out, it's pivotal moments in the narrative of your story, the other guy's story, the narrative of the whole organization, and you only get one go at it.
A live take.
Right. You get a live take, and it's got to be. The respect that I have for you guys as athletes and entertainers is just holds no bounds.
I appreciate that. It's interesting because it's like an ensemble cast.
Yeah,
there's some people on the show that I've known for years that I've never done a scene with, a match with.
Yeah,
you know, and I never thought of that before.
But when you, it's the same with us. But when you get when you get together and you see each other, you still feel part of this team.
Because we're part of the cast.
Yeah, you still feel that you're on the same ship and pulling in the same direction. So it feels like all of these, and it's a very beautiful thing when you get lots of people who are just cogs in a machine.
Well, yeah. And I also tell like people too, it's like a good sports team, whether you're a football fan or hockey or whatever it may be.
Yeah.
Sometimes you are the leader in the game. You play 30 minutes and you're the quarterback. And other times you're on for two plays, but you got to make sure you block the pass or whatever it may be.
Yeah.
It's the same with our show and probably the same with yours. If you have one scene in a given episode, you better go out there and kill that scene.
Oh, completely.
Because if you don't, the whole show could fall apart when it gets to your scene.
Yeah. And that's the great thing about it, because the trust has developed over the years and you become fans of other people. You know that every other scene is going to have actors that are playing at the top of their game.
Yeah.
So what you got to make sure you don't do is let the side down with yours.
Mm-hmm.
You think it would create pressure, the fact that you've got to follow a scene with Peter Dinklage that then goes into a scene after you with Diana Rigg and Jonathan Pryce.
Yeah.
You think, oh, how am I going to possibly hold up to these guys? But all you got to do is just hold your, make sure that your patch of the quilt is as strong as it can be.
Good, yeah.
And then the through line will work.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
A couple last questions. What's your favorite McCartney song?
My favorite solo or Beatles?
Both. Pick one for me each.
My favorite McCartney Beatles song is probably For No One.
Oh, interesting.
Off Revolver.
Yeah.
That's what I love about...
He's playing Here, There, Everywhere on this tour as well.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah. What I love about the Beatles is, you know, you get the greatest hits Beatles. You get that number one 27 songs thing. But if you were to just listen to the albums and just listen to them... This is what I... If I could go back to any time in kind of pop culture, it would be to the times when a new Beatles record was coming out, a new LP was coming out, and you went out, you bought it, you brought it home, you've got no idea what it's going to be like. Absolutely no idea. And you listen to it, you experience that for the first time, not cherry-picking the song that you want, but buying an LP with them all on, that would be...
And not knowing what to expect, and probably having to get used to each... transition.
Yeah.
Because I know how I am, you know, like, for example, when the Metallica Black album came out, they turned from these, like, long thrash songs to very concise, almost AC/DC type tunes.
Yeah.
And I hated it at first.
Yeah.
I can see me doing that between, you know, Revolver and Pepper, where Revolver's, you know,
I know.
Or even Rubber Soul to Revolver or Pepper to White Album. But that's the genius of that band.
It is. I mean, it's interesting the fact that you do get Pepper and then that the Magical Mystery Tour album, which is quite pepperish and kind of
sure,
quite
out there. Yeah.
And then the White album.
Which is just completely out in space.
It's insane.
Yeah, a song like Wild Honey Pie or something like Honey Pie. It's just like, what the hell is this?
In a way, it's more insane than Pepper and Magical Mystery Tour because it's so unpredictable.
I agree.
Oh, and my favorite McCartney solo.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you're counting Wings as solo.
Yeah, sure, of course.
I really like Let Me Roll It.
Oh, that's a great tune.
Still
plays that.
Yeah, he does. And he does a kind of Foxy Lady tribute at the end.
Yeah.
But a record came out, I think, Christmas before last, which is called The Art of McCartney.
Yeah.
It's a great record.
Yeah.
And on that, Paul Rodgers does Let Me Roll It.
Oh,
right?
Cool.
It's absolutely
Sounds great.
And Bob Dylan does... Things We Said Today.
Kiss does Venus and Mars.
It's amazing.
There's a lot of great stuff on
there. There's so much great stuff on there. And that just shows you just, A, the kind of universal themes that McCartney talks about in terms of anybody can relate to it. But just the melodies are so singable.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And you could go see a McCartney show where he plays 38 songs.
Yeah.
And think of another 38 songs that he could have played.
Oh, completely,
The show would be just as good.
Yeah. When I saw him last year, he did Being for the Benefit of Mr. Kite.
Yeah.
Which wasn't, it's not even one of his tunes.
I know.
It's so firmly a John tune. But he's at the level now where he feels he can do all that. Because he didn't play Beatles
for
tunes in concert for years.
In the 90s and 80s. I mean, even when Wings started, he didn't do any Beatles tunes.
Which is a very brave thing to do, but it's a guy who's... He's a guy who's always got faith in...
Well, once again, he didn't want to be typecast.
Yeah, completely.
He wanted to completely reinvent himself, and that means you can't go back to the well and do the Beatles tunes.
I know, and he's still innovative. His last album, was the Kisses on the Bottom before or after that? I think it was before that.
New was the one that was very still avant-garde, a lot of electronic stuff.
And the challenge of working with three different producers on one album shows a guy who's very ambitious.
I thought that was a really good record. I heard Alligator today. I hadn't heard it for a while. It's like, that's a good tune, man.
It's a great tune.
You know?
It's a great tune, and he's singing for his voice more. I actually think it's a great time for a lot of those older guys. I think Bob Dylan in the last 10 years... Has gone ice cool.
Have you heard of this massive gig that they're trying to play for Coachella?
Unbelievable.
Dylan, the Stones, Neil Young, and McCartney.
And Roger Waters.
The Who. And Roger Waters.
I mean, come on.
I mean, that's like the biggest gig
of all
time.
How do you get into that gig?
I don't even know. Like, how would you get into it, even getting a ticket?
Yeah, I don't know.
And then getting into that Coachella is nuts. But I mean, you know, I like the idea of it.
Yeah.
More than how the hell would I get in there, you know?
Yeah, the idea of it. I mean, I think they're going to divide it up, I think.
Three nights.
Three nights, and Dylan and the Stones, and then McCartney and
Neil and the Stones. Or sorry, Neil and McCartney. Paul.
Yeah, and then
Who and Waters.
Wow.
I mean, yeah.
What more do you want?
I know. I mean, like I know. You said, all these guys, and that's what I love about. They're all in their 70s, but that doesn't matter anymore.
Yeah,
they all just are great musicians and they rock.
Yeah, they are, and you know, like we were saying before about you know, character actors being of lead actors mm-hmm. being of a certain age now, they've all found they're all who they are now.
Yeah.
Especially, I've seen Bob Dylan a few times, and people say that Bob Dylan isn't that great live anymore. I actually think he is. But every time you see him, if you see him a couple of years apart, you're seeing a slightly different version of him.
Mm-hmm. Never the same thing.
Never the same thing. I saw him before and after he did that that American Standards album that he
mm-hmm.
did.
Mm-hmm.
And he was slightly different. He was doing them, and he's discovered that he can sing.
Yeah.
He can really sing on that record, and I've heard a couple of tracks off his new record, and he can sing on that as well. Mm-hmm. That's what I think is what's great.
Whether he chooses to sing or not, I think sometimes he likes to just go into his nasal Dylan voice.
Yeah.
Because I think, that feels good for me right now. I'll do that tonight.
But he's showing a really romantic, old-fashioned, vulnerable side
to
him.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which I think is really attractive in a guy of his age.
What I love about it, too, like especially Dylan and the Stones, and in the Who, to an extent, they all grew up being huge blues fans.
Yeah.
And now they're all old blues men. Like,
I know.
You know, the Stones are Howlin' Wolf and Muddy Waters and all those guys they used to go nuts for in the 60s. They have become that. Like, they're a great old blues band now.
I know. And that's
just cool.
But what's what I love about them, the fact that, I mean, the Stones experimented with a load of different forms mm-hmm. of music, especially mm-hmm. in the kind of 80s.
Yeah.
But they will, I think they're releasing a blues album this year or maybe next year.
I'll be the first in line to get it.
They always come back.
Yeah.
To the things that they loved. Yeah. Anyway, it's the same with the Beatles. They started off as a rock and roll band, mm-hmm. doing one take stuff all in the same room. They went a bit crazy.
Yeah.
And then Abbey Road and Let It Be are just both rock albums.
Yeah, back on the rooftop.
Noel Gallagher, which I think is one of the best quotes about the Beatles ever. I think it was Noel Gallagher. He said, the Beatles up until 64, 65 showed that they were the best pop group ever. And then 65 to 70, they showed they were the best rock group ever.
Hmm.
I mean?
It's a great point, yeah.
It's great.
Just the invention and the...
You can drop into any Beatles record, and I'm kind of... they're the only band who I like everything.
Maybe take, like, Act Naturally or something like that. A couple of those Ringo tunes or not.
That's
exactly
kind of got
its
charm to it, but I'd never listen to them more than once.
Yeah.
I'd never listen to Revolution 9 more than
Well, if they once. Have 250 songs, 245 of them are great.
Yeah, it's which is an unbelievable...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Last question. Who's your favorite character on Game of Thrones besides you, and what's your favorite scene that you've ever been in on Game of Thrones?
My favorite character... Then this... It kind of... changes all the time,
mm-hmm.
but I think at the moment, if I can just relate it to music for a second, it kind of the Beatles and AC/DC are my long-term partners, but I have flings with lots of other bands. I have flings with lots of other characters, but my favorite character is one of them is definitely Lord Varys,
mm-hmm.
the eunuch at King's Landing.
Yeah,
because I think he's such a great.
He's very flamboyant, feminine.
But he's also such a great examination of how a lot of the genuine power lies in the background.
Mm.
You know what I mean? It's not always the guy that you most suspect. It's the guy... He's literally the whispering guy.
That's right.
Who has the ears of everybody who you'd assume is mm-hmm. at the forefront of being in power. Can actually influence a lot by staying in the background and staying slightly underground.
Right.
He can have a huge influence on it. And it's also down to the performance as well. Mm. Conleth Hill, who's a great friend of mine, who I love very much, he's incredible in that part. And it's about how... One thing I love about this show is that if the guys in charge like an actor and like a performance, they'll give them so much to do.
Right.
And it's all about knowing what the audience responds to. They reward good performances mm-hmm. with more screen time.
Right.
And I think that's to their credit, and it really strives everybody to be... makes everybody strive to be as good as they can.
I've noticed that with... I love Tyrion Lannister, Peter Dinklage.
Yeah.
I love the fact that he's... very obviously diminutive physically but mentally he's the smartest guy in that world.
Oh yeah,
you know, he's a manipulator, and I just love the way he conducts
incredible
his mind basically.
Yeah, I think that's one of the great maybe I think people are realizing it's one of the rare things when people are actually realizing now how good it is.
Yeah. In retrospect, like I said, you go back and watch him
that performance,
from the start.
Yeah.
That's always been his MO, but you never noticed it at first.
No, but he's... There are certain parts in this show where I think they were given to people who were the only people who could really play them in the world. Mm. Or the best person to play them in the world.
The proverbial, they were born to play this part.
Yeah, I think that Peter's one of those.
Yeah.
I think Gwendolyn Christie, who plays Brienne, is one of those.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's a good thing for actors to bear in mind that, you know, you may not come out of drama school and get your dream part straight away, but just be patient, because stick in the game, and the part you were born to play may come up when you're
at least
30, 35, 40, 50.
Look at Bryan Cranston with
exactly. Look at Bryan Cranston, and what I always say is it's all about patience and commitment. And the one thing, just as a kind of final point, what I always say is, if your ideal part comes along on the Wednesday, what if you'd given up on the Tuesday?
Mm-hmm. Great point. What's your favorite scene that you ever did as Sam?
There's two, really, and they're vastly different. The scene in the first episode that he's in, where he goes to the top of the wall and he basically explains to John why he's at Castle Black. He explains to him that his father basically kicked him out, mm-hmm. because he was a disappointment, and he's been banished there completely against his will, because it's a place for ruthless guys.
Sure.
For criminals.
He's so out of place.
Yeah. And guys who are fighting, really unpleasant guys. So John asks him, what are you doing here? And he tells him, and he's very candid and he's very honest. And at that moment, Sam starts to make sense, because everybody else has been wondering what he's doing there.
Mm-hmm.
You're clearly not a criminal. You're clearly not a fighter or a cutthroat. Why are you amongst these people? And it's only when he explains to him that you realize that his situation is completely impossible, and he's been really damaged by life, damaged by his father. His father's really, for want of a better expression, f***ed him up for his entire life. And when you get to realize that and you have this peak inside his heart, that's when you really start to have
sympathy for him,
I think. And I think another scene is later on, it's in season 5, where Sam is essential in getting John elected as Lord Commander in season 5, which I think is a really good scene, because it's quite a difficult acting job to do that, because Sam wants it to come across like he's speaking from his heart and wants it to come across as an impassioned kind of impulsive speech on the spur of the moment. But in actual fact, what it is, it's an acting job by Sam, because he knows that John being Lord Commander is the best chance that he's got of getting Gilly and Baby Sam out of Castle Black and getting them safe. That's what his narrative was over that entire season. So when he's speaking in front of the whole Night's Watch and making this plea for John, he's trying to make it look like he's going to lose it, and his emotions are getting the better of him. But all along, he's very conscious of what he's doing, and he's playing it with real political rhetoric. And I think that's when you see just what a manipulator he can be.
How he's learning,
yeah. But how he can always manipulate people.
That's right, he's learning how to manipulate people. Yeah,
learning how to. And I think he's always had that. You've seen flashes of that throughout the season, influencing John all the time. John wants to make decisions, and John's very impulsive, and he thinks, I'm going to do this, and Sam's the one who says, no, you don't want to do that.
You don't want to do that because this, this, and this.
And he makes him change his mind on numerous occasions, and we've seen that a lot, but I think that one was the kind of purified form of that.
I'm looking forward to seeing the badass Sam, the wizard.
Who knows?
Thanks, man.
Thank you, Chris.
I know for a fact that some of the officers go to that brothel in Molestown. I wouldn't doubt it. Well, don't you think it's a little bit unfair, making us take our vows while they sneak off for a little Sally on the side?
Sally on the side?
It's silly, isn't it? What, we can't defend the wall unless we celebrate? It's absurd.
I didn't think you'd be so upset about it.
Why not? Because I'm fat.
No.
But I like girls just as much as you do. They might not like me as much.
I've never been with one. You probably had hundreds.
No. As a matter of fact, the same as you.
I find that hard to believe. I
came very close once. I was alone in a room with a naked girl.
Didn't know where to put it.
I know where to put it.
All right. Game of Thrones season 6 starts this Sunday on HBO. Can't wait. Thanks to John Bradley. What a sweet guy. He plays Samwell Tarly, as you know. Thanks to him for sitting down and sharing some great stories about being on the set of Game of Thrones. Thanks to Andy Biersack for setting up this interview. And thanks to you guys for listening twice a week right here on Talk is Jericho. And thanks for subscribing on iTunes and getting all your friends to subscribe and leave 5-star ratings and comments. Thanks for supporting all the great sponsors of Talk is Jericho, including Amazon. And listen, buy whatever you want on Amazon, and all you Talk is Jericho Amazon warriors, take a picture of what you bought and post it up on the Twitter at Talk is Jericho. I will free tweet it and I'll follow you. How's that? Use the Talk is Jericho links to get to Amazon, and find those links by going to podcast1.com. Click on the killer deals button in the top right corner of the page, then hit that Talk is Jericho button. Amazon links for USA, UK, Canada. Still working on France, but you got the first three. Every time you use the Talk is Jericho Amazon links, Amazon kicks back a small percentage to the show to help us cover production costs. No extra fees or charges. Just go to podcast1.com. Click on the killer deals button in the top right corner of the page, then hit the Talk is Jericho button. All the great sponsors are there as well. DDP Yoga and the DDP Yoga Now app. Go to ddpyoga.com/Jericho. Get 3 free months of the DDP Yoga Now app, okay? Harrys.com. Use my promo code Jericho to get $5 off your first purchase. Works. Use that Works switch driver. It's amazing. Use the promo code Chris to get 10% off your order and free shipping. Uber, Guitar Center. Thanks to all of the great sponsors. And thanks to you guys for listening. Don't forget, this Sunday I will be on Talking Dead after Fear the Walking Dead on AMC. I'm flying straight from Spain all the way to LA. Land for the afternoon. Bust out the show. Then take the red eye back to Hartford. I'm going to be a tired dude, but it's worth it. It's a great show, and this is a great show. Thanks for listening, and thanks for listening to the 60-second AP News headlines coming up next. Next week, the continuing guests, the cavalcade of awesome guests continues. So we'll see you then. Stay hard, stay hungry. Peace, love, and hugs, and a big yeah, boy.
You can download new episodes of Talk is Jericho every Wednesday and Friday at podcast1.com. That's podcastone.com.
Daddy, where do babies come from?
Honey?
Mommy went to the store.
Oh, well, you see, there's a mommy and a daddy, right?
Right.
And see, when they call Geico, they could save a bunch of money on car insurance.
Oh, really? And that makes them happy?
Yes, that makes them very happy.
That's good.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad we could have this talk, Sunshine.
Geico, because saving 15% or more on car insurance is always a great answer.
It's your last chance to get great holiday savings at Guitar Center. Like a Simmons SD550 electronic drum kit, just $399. Add your choice of AKG K52 headphones or a Shure SM48 mic, each just $39. Plus, the newest and hottest guitars, drums, keys, and more. Exclusive gear you can't get anywhere else. Special financing, lessons for the beginner on your list, and gift cards. The perfect present for every musician. So hurry in and find your sound at Guitar Center.
Trump's victory. I'm Ed Donahue with an AP News Minute.
It's always a lot of fun when you win. If you work hard and lose, that's not acceptable.
At the White House, President Trump welcomed Republicans from the House and the Senate who passed a bill overhauling the tax code. The president says the middle class will be seeing the effects of this bill very soon.
The typical family of four earning $75,000 will see an income tax cut of more than $2,000. They're going to have $2,000, and that's, in my opinion, going to be less than the average. You're going to have a lot more than that.
The tax overhaul bill also includes a corporate tax cut.
We have companies pouring back into our country, and that means jobs, and it means really the formation of new, young, beautiful, strong companies.
Democrats have criticized the tax package as a giveaway to corporations and the rich. The tax cuts for businesses are permanent under this tax bill, but reductions for individuals and families will expire after a decade. I'm Ed Donahue.